Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Public broadcasting was created in 1967 with the passage of the Public Broadcasting Act and the creation of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Originally intended to fund the production of educational programming for television, the act also called for the creation of public radio. 2 years later, in 1969, the founding board of National Public Radio came into being to guide the creation of a distinctly different form of radio with a unique mission. Today, that mission is at risk due to the elimination of funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Last week, Congress voted to do just that, accomplishing what some on the right have dreamed of for years. The impact of eliminating $1.8 billion in funding will be felt profoundly in communities large and small nationwide. WFAE has already taken steps to deal with the loss of revenue by eliminating some staff. Similar moves are likely to be made at public radio and TV stations everywhere and may impact programming. This hour, we look at that impact and at what stations in this region are doing to protect their future as best they can. And later, we'll hear from the CEO of WFAE and that of Blue Ridge Public Radio, along with the general manager of WDAV, the classical music public station here in Charlotte. But first, I want to examine just what public radio is supposed to be, how it came to be, and why. Bill Siemering is widely regarded as the father of public radio. He was among the members of the founding board of directors for NPR and wrote the mission statement for the organization. As NPR's first director of programming, Siemering led the creation of All Things Considered in 1971 and went on to play a role in creating and improving many aspects of public radio, including the development of the program that eventually became Fresh Air. Bill Siemering joins us now. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Mike. And it's wonderful to be on a program called Charlotte Talks. That, in a way, is what radio is about, hearing voices from the community.
Yeah, people probably don't know this, but NPR is very special at using sound, audible sound, natural sound, music, etc., to tell stories. And that was your idea.
Getting out of the studio, right, and not sounding so sterile and not sounding with a big voice of authority, male voice of authority, that was standard at that time.
I want to go back
to a more conversational style.
Yeah, I want to go back and look at that in a moment, because I think people who are young and who have grown up on NPR don't realize what this medium was like prior to the creation of NPR. But you wrote the mission statement for National Public Radio. It reads in part, National Public Radio will serve the individual. It will promote personal growth. It will regard the individual differences among men with respect and joy rather than derision and hate. It will celebrate the human experience as infinitely varied rather than vacuous and banal. It will encourage a sense of active, constructive participation rather than apathetic helplessness. And you go on to describe in some detail the objectives of NPR, including its journalistic objectives, which you said would actively explore, investigate, and interpret issues of national and international import. The programs will enable the individual to better understand himself, his government, his institutions, and his natural and social environment so he can intelligently participate in effecting the process of change. In your opinion, is NPR, have we lived up to those mission statements, to those goals?
I think so, yes. And I'll just add one other, one other thing. When I started working it as the first director of programming in December of, I'm sorry, in November of 1972, I wrote a memo to the president, and I said, unless National Public Radio is able to offer a significant alternative to the present media mix in America, unless it is actively involved in trying to solve the critical problems in America, then it probably isn't worth the effort. And so there's an kind of an active citizen participation theme that we've heard here. And now we are faced with many other objects in the landscape, if you will, in the media landscape. And it's up for us now to kind of find the unique niche for us. I'm using we as if I'm actively involved in broadcasting right now, but you understand. But, you know, the idea that there are two ideas that came through what you read. One was this active informing people so they active with intelligence. Because the greatest threat to democracy in a way is ignorance.
Yes.
Of people not, you can't have the right decisions coming from the wrong information.
And for the longest time, there are people on the right who there are several philosophical reasons that they don't like public radio. One is they don't necessarily believe in government tax dollars being spent on something like this. And the other is that they have the impression that we are left-leaning, which we can talk about as we go through the program. But I want to go back to the beginnings, not just of NPR and public television, but to the beginnings of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, because its creation, as I understand it, was a bipartisan effort. It was Republicans and Democrats. Why was the creation of public broadcasting deemed desirable or even necessary outside of people in the business?
Well, part of it stems from a talk that was given by Newton Minow, who was then chairman of the FCC, talking about television as a vast wasteland. And Bill Moyers, who passed recently, was working as chief of staff to Lyndon Johnson. And among other things, he helped start the Peace Corps. So he had this great idea of, and talking to others, of using, you know, of the need for public broadcasting. And so that's how that came. I wanted just, if I may, hop back in time further. You mentioned educational radio. And that radio itself started as an educational medium, of course. It started arguably at the University of Wisconsin. Some would say that was, there's another, but I started my work in public radio at the University of Wisconsin. I worked my way through the university there. And it was a very strong station because there was what they call the Wisconsin idea. An earlier president of the university said, I will not be satisfied until every home feels the beneficence of the university. And that gave rise to the idea of getting the resources out. And land-grant colleges were set up by that, by Abraham Lincoln, actually. So the idea of using radio was natural in that context. In fact, the fact that the term broadcast originally meant broadcasting seeds, scattering seeds. Mm. And that's my favorite metaphor for what we're doing yet. So I'm sorry I'm just giving this earlier picture because the roots of our work are deep, literally, in a way.
And many public radio stations today started out life as educational radio stations and television stations. And there's a difference between educational broadcasting and public broadcasting. There's
exactly. And that's what I was thinking when CPB was formed. And I thought, public means inclusion. It means everyone.
So in the cradle of public radio, you described NPR as a medium that would not regard its audience as a market or in terms of its disposable income, but as curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience. prior to public broadcasting, everything was commercial. It was all about selling ads, making money, etc. There are those who agree with those goals, but who don't want to see public tax dollars spent on this. So could this type of broadcasting, could it have developed, could it have flourished, will it continue to flourish in the absence of public tax dollar funding?
Well, I guess it remains to be seen. I think it will. In a way, it's like this child's game of pick up sticks. You know, you scatter little sticks around, and you try to pick them up carefully. I think we're going to see new strategies, new associations, and things like that. It's interesting that the BBC, the people there pay $235 a year for it. In Canada, it's about $33 comes out of taxpayers' money for their service. And here in the States, it's like $1.60 per taxpayer. So I think it's well proven itself as a unique service, independent of commercial and now political pressures we're seeing with CBS and so on.
That $1.60 that you referred to is the money that came to and then went out from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Yes. And it supported not just radio, but it supported television. And a lot of the money doesn't go directly to NPR or to PBS. It goes to the local stations who then buy programming from those entities. You created All Things Considered, which, along with Morning Edition, have become the tentpole programs for NPR and much of public radio. That the title of All Things Considered is purposeful, but it also means that people listening will be exposed to people, to topics, to points of view that some may find annoying or distasteful or which challenge their personal beliefs. And some on the right, as I said, have seen public radio programming as left-leaning. Is that why?
Well, we've now become such a divided society that speaking about climate change would be considered left-leaning because some on the right think it's a hoax. So that's one thing. As Catherine Marr, the president of NPR, said, just having people of color on does not mean that it's woke.
Right. I have about a minute left in this segment, and I wanted to get your thoughts, since you're a visionary, you're the person behind the creation of NPR and everything we've come to know as public radio. Do you have any ideas on how stations, how NPR, how local television stations can persevere in the face of this defunding of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting? And I have less than a minute.
Let me pick that up later. I don't want to try to ram it into less than a minute.
Okay, well, I'll let you do that. We'll bring you back on the other side of the break to do that. And when we come back, we'll also bring in the general manager, the CEO and president of WFAE, the general manager of WDAV, and the CEO of Blue Ridge Public Radio, all stations and entities that are being impacted by this defunding of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And I want to make sure everybody understands that our protocol here at WFAE for reporting on ourself, because of that protocol, the company's executive leadership did not review any of today's questions. We are solely produced by our own staff here at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the impact of the defunding of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and what that means for public radio and public television stations across the country. We'll meet several leaders of several area public stations in just a moment, but I want to conclude my conversation with Bill Siemering first. He's a founding member of NPR and the creator of All Things Considered. And I asked you a question that's impossible. This is my famous trademark, Bill, to ask impossible questions with a minute left, and I pulled it on you, and you wouldn't let me get away with it. So I'm gonna give you some time to answer the question as a visionary, as the person who created essentially public radio, and certainly Fresh Air and All Things Considered. Do you have any ideas on how public radio, public television, can survive these cuts from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
Well, I think there are all these new platforms and ways of reaching the public. I'm just so impressed with WFAE's website, with the focus on local, and for example, covering school board meetings and showing the empty laundromat because of the fear of going there. I mean, and, you know, looking at your website is like reading the newspaper. You've covered all the local issues. And I think local, if we can use this as an intro to the rest of your program, the focus on local is one key to that, I think. People are so hungry for connection nowadays. And it comes through radio, I think, because it's such an intimate medium. Yeah. The human voice is so expressive, and you can talk about things that you couldn't talk about on television or see in print. I think we have, actually, as a sidebar, I think we have more in common with print than we do with television, because we can work alone, and we tend to be a little on the introvert side, some of us, and
so, and it's based in words and not pictures.
Yes. And the human voice, there's an interview that Terry Gross did with Maurice Sendak, the last one when he knew he was dying, is one of the most intimate exchanges you can imagine. And television would have not been possible. And you wouldn't get it in print.
Bill Siemering is one of the founders of what has come to be known as NPR today, All Things Considered, and a groundbreaking visionary in the world of public radio. Bill, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to join us this morning on this program. I appreciate it.
Sure. And now you'll hear some examples of great community. Local radio.
Well, local is the key to it, and that's also the challenge to it, it seems to me, because without money, it takes people to do local radio and to report in the way that you just described our website, which is also duplicated on our radio station. Some lawmakers have couched the cuts to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as necessary to help pay for new Republican priorities, like the expansion of immigration enforcement and the extension of the Trump tax cuts. But that is not what this is about, because Trump has said the quiet part out loud. He has reportedly claimed that NPR and PBS demonstrate ideological bias and ramped up pressure on wavering lawmakers by posting on Truth Social recently, quote, "Any Republican that votes to allow this monstrosity to continue broadcasting will not have my support or endorsement." The impact of these cuts is already being felt at stations large and small. And last week, WFAE announced a reduction in workforce of at least 6 people, along with some others who are voluntarily leaving, in what is likely only the first round of layoffs. This is money that was promised and which was planned for in the station's budget and which is now gone. But as I said, we are not alone, and so for the rest of this hour, we look at how these cuts will likely affect other stations in our region and how they serve their listeners and cover their communities. We're joined by Jadon Marshall, President and CEO of WFAE, Ellie Ellis is CEO and General Manager of Blue Ridge Public Radio, and Frank Dominguez is General Manager of Charlotte's Classical Music Public Station, WDAV in Davidson. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. So how much money, Jadon, I'll start with you since you're the boss here, how much money will WFAE lose as a result of these cuts, and how much of our total funding does that amount to?
So there, the two ways that we look at CPB funding, one is in direct funding, so direct dollars that come to support our operations, and that's around $430,000 to $450,000. There's about an additional $300,000+ that comes in indirect support. So everything from music licensing to some of the other kinds of grants that NPR provides, our publishing systems are all supported by CPB dollars. And so we've worked with NPR to figure out those calculations, and that brings that total to about $800,000 in lost support.
And our publishing systems are things like our website, like our digital platform for audio, podcast, et cetera.
Exactly.
Ellie, same question to you. How much money will you lose, and what will this do to you?
We're looking at about $330,000. That's our CPB grant. And we have all of the other things that you have, the web, the music licensing, the interconnect. That's about 9% of our budget.
Yeah, people may not know that if you hear a piece of music on the radio, we have to pay the rights to use that piece of music, and we do it through a blanket agreement. And for a music station like WDAV, how does that work? How will this affect you? How much money are you losing, Frank?
Well, specifically in terms of the amount that we're losing, it's about $250,000. And when our budget is a $2.2 million budget, that's obviously a big chunk. It's like kicking off one of the legs of the stool. As Judon pointed out, and you've mentioned too, Mike, the rights to play the music is something that is negotiated by CPB with rights holders. People think of radio as being free and that you play the recordings at no cost. That's not exactly true, because even in a format like classical music, where a lot of the composers are dead, there are still additions that have been edited by musicians, and there are all sorts of rights that are
held. They're performed by orchestras,
exactly,
and musicians.
Performed by,
yes,
orchestras, and all of that has financial licensing fees involved. And a lot of music stations are sort of lost, not knowing what's going to happen, yeah, exactly, how it's going to impact our budgets to calculate that factor, in addition to what we're losing from the community service grants. So it really presents a dilemma and a kind of existential challenge for music stations in particular.
This cut in funding was not set in stone, but it seemed fairly certain that it was coming. And so, Judon, we have been planning for this. We haven't. You have.
Mm-hmm.
And others in the management team have been planning for this over time. And as I said, last week we announced layoffs of about 6 people. Some people took buyouts. Some people went part-time from full-time. And there are likely more of these cuts to come. How do you choose who to lay off and who to keep?
It's a tough decision. WFAE is not a big organization. You know, I tell everybody that every person that we have here is essential personnel to accomplishing the mission and vision that we have. You know, what it in fact means is that we just had to look strategically across the organization and figure out places where we could absorb responsibilities. So somebody goes away, somebody else's job gets a lot tougher. We spread that work across the staff. You know, I'm a very hands-on CEO, so I'm involved in some very tactical things to make the mission work. And so, you know, there's no easy choice there. It's just working with our managers to determine what's the best way forward, given the circumstances.
Ellie, have you had to face this problem yet at Blue Ridge Public Radio?
We haven't. I'm here about 9 weeks now. And so I came in knowing this was going to happen and starting to figure out the fundraising from there. And I believe we're going to be able to raise the $330,000 this year. As for the music rights and all of those things, I don't know what's going to happen with those things yet, but I'm not ready to cut staff. I don't think we're going to have to do that this year.
What about WDAV?
We're not planning to cut any staff either, but we are planning to try to raise more money. But some things will need to be cut because in my experience as general manager over about 14 years now, we've been in deficit situations in the past. And the only way to get out of it is to cut something and raise some extra money. It's a balancing act. It's not like you can find $250,000 easily to replace what's going away.
I certainly don't want to minimize WDAV or other music stations who face the same kinds of cutbacks that we will be facing, but it's probably more, I would wager, it is probably more expensive to do the kind of programming that WFAE and Blue Ridge Public Radio does than perhaps playing music, and that's not to denigrate you in any way, but I know this takes a lot of people to accomplish what we do here or try to do here. And over the years, as we've said many times in fundraising, Jadon, we only can do this because of our listeners. And our listeners have asked increasingly over the years, as the news landscape has changed, for us to do more.
That's
correct. And because of their support, we have been able to do more. But we have been facing not only this cut now, this sudden cut from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but declining revenues from underwriting announcements that you hear sporadically during our broadcast. Those who underwrite our programming do so because they believe in the mission of public radio, because there's no superlatives, there's no personal pronouns in those underwriting announcements, there's no come on down, we're dealing. It's simply we're here because we support public radio, and you have to be a very specific kind of organization to benefit on your side from supporting public radio. And we're thankful for those who find it in their budgets to do so. But that's decreased. Philanthropy has decreased. This is kind of like a perfect storm.
It really is. It really is. I mean, when we go out and we talk to our corporate partners, one of the things we first acknowledge is that if they are just trying to reach people, there are better ways to just reach mass numbers of people. When you partner with WFAE as a corporate sponsor or underwriter, you really are making a values-based decision. You are saying that you're investing in Charlotte, and because of the work that WFAE does to connect and build those relationships and to help make Charlotte stronger, you want to be aligned with WFAE. That's a luxury that not a lot of businesses have, but that's a luxury that we've taken advantage of in this community because we have so many community-minded institutions. I think what we're seeing in this current climate is a shift really since January with the change of the administration, where all of the executive orders that have come down have really shifted, and really people who were leaning into community engagement and community building don't know where the landmines are. And so they've started to pull back some of that support. Now, that's not the only issue. We've seen corporate support decline over several years, but it feels different in this year.
We are in the midst of an emergency fund drive.
Yes.
Which began this morning. And the emergency fund drive is due to this cut of money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. How much, knowing how much the average listener who does, not everybody contributes, not everybody becomes a member of all these public radio stations, but they listen because it's free to listen. But based on the average contribution of the listeners who do participate, how do you calculate what it will take to make up what we're losing from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
That's a great question, Mike, because, you know, we've looked at calculations that said if every member gave X dollars, right? Like if everybody gave $7 more, what a big difference that would make. If, you know, 10% versus 5% of our listeners would actually contribute, you know, what a tremendous difference that would make. So it's a very interesting question. What we see in terms of actual giving is that those sustainers, people who are giving on a monthly basis, are the ones who give more one-time gifts, who give more increase in their actual dollars. And so a lot of the growth, you know, is reliant on sustainers. And we've actually seen people move from one-time annual gifts to sustainers. So that's why you hear a lot of our messaging focus on and getting the sustainers to increase just slightly.
LA Charlotte's a bigger market than perhaps Asheville and some of the areas that Blue Ridge Public Radio covers. And I know that you said you're losing about $330,000 from CPB. How do you make up that difference to the available channels that you have access to?
I think it's the same thing. We'll do it through on-air fundraising. We'll do it through major giving. We have a lot of donors in Asheville that give at the larger levels, and we're working to increase that. Right now we're doing a raffle where we're giving away a car, and that's going really well. We decided not to go with an emergency fund drive because we were already fundraising on the air for the raffle. But I would expect our fall drive would look a lot like your emergency fund drive's looking right now.
Ellie, for our listeners here in Charlotte, talk about your coverage area and the communities that have come to depend on what Blue Ridge Public Radio offers and what you provide. What would it mean for your region if you have to reduce personnel or if you have to stop carrying programs from NPR and other producing entities that provide public radio stations with programming?
Well, I'm going to start with your first question, because I think it's really important to recognize that BPR covers 14 counties and the Quala boundary. So we are hitting all of Western North Carolina in valleys and peaks that don't have anything else. It's news deserts in some of those places. But also we have a classical station as well, classical and jazz. So we're reaching everybody with news and, you know, entertainment and music and delight as well. If we were to have to cut things, we would be taking the only news source away from some of those towns. And, you know, I would use the example from this year. It's a horrible example, but it's the one that we have, which is when Hurricane Helene hit, there was no print journalism that could get out to people. There were no websites that could get out to people. The people of Asheville didn't have power. They didn't have internet. They didn't have water.
They didn't have cell phones.
They didn't have cell phones. So what BPR did was, first of all, our broadcast coverage increased. We went entirely to Helene coverage for a very long time. We did Buncombe County 10 and 4 press conferences every day. And we have pictures and story after story of listeners that went out to the street with their crank radio, cranked it up, put it on their mailbox, and then all the neighbors came over, all their friends came over to hear what was going on in the city at 10 and 4 every day. Or someone would turn on their car with the gas that they had and drive up in the middle of the street, and all the neighbors and friends could come hear what was going on. We were on the air talking about it when the first water distribution site was announced. They announced that live. And then at night, we repeated things. And we did all of those little towns, some of those little towns, I don't want to say all, but some of those towns did the same kind of update during the day. And we played those at night. And we played some of them in Spanish at night, so that we were really how people could get coverage. But what I was most impressed with, and it's important to remember I didn't work here yet, but what I was most impressed with was when they decided to go with text message news. So what would happen is they would put together these texts and send them out. And when you managed to get cell service, so if you drove up the street or if you went up the mountain or whatever you had to do to get that 30 seconds of cell service that you could get, you'd get a text message so that you didn't have to load a page with pictures. You would just get the news and it would be on your phone and you would have it. It was amazing.
Ellie Ellis is the CEO and general manager of Blue Ridge Public Radio. She is here along with Frank Dominguez, general manager of WDAV, the classical music NPR station in Charlotte, and our own CEO and president of WFAE, Judon Marshall. We will continue our conversation about the future of public broadcasting when we come back in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the future of public broadcasting and public radio in particular in light of the recent cut on last week, Friday of last week, to funds coming from and to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, much of which comes to radio stations and television stations around the country that identify themselves as public broadcasting stations. We're here with Judon Marshall, the CEO and president of WFAE, Ellie Ellis, the CEO and general manager of Blue Ridge Public Radio, and Frank Dominguez is general manager of WDAV. Public radio, Judon, was designed intentionally to avoid airing commercials in order to preserve editorial independence. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to fund public service and nonprofit stations to that end. And the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, prohibits nonprofit stations from airing commercials. And we don't want to air commercials because they take time away from content and because it creates an editorial, a potential for editorial interference, let's put it that way. But let me commit heresy here for a moment.
Okay.
Given the fact that they've taken away the funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, should we ask for permission to carry commercials, to pay the freight?
No.
Why not?
Well, we're still, even without funding, we're still regulated by the FCC that allows us to have these licenses for educational programming. And so anything that puts us in a position where we are now competing head-to-head with commercial broadcasters that have substantially larger budgets than ours, right, who can
air commercials. But that's why they have substantially larger budgets. I used to work for one.
Well, that is correct. That is correct. Well, so there's that, right? Like, to retain sort of our nonprofit status, being free of commercials is one part of that. The other part of that is that we want people to really trust the news that they receive from WFAE. Not saying that those who receive commercials can't be trusted. I won't make a commentary about that. But what I will say is that when you listen to WFAE, you can be assured that the programming that you hear is free from the pressures of those kinds of interests, that this is not pay for play, that we go out, we talk to our listeners, we talk to our community members, and that what you hear on air really reflects the needs of this organization's community.
You're in a little bit of a different situation, Frank, at WDAV, because you are also part of Davidson College. I'm not sure that you want to air commercials or that would even be on the horizon for you, but how would you feel about it? How would the college feel about it? And how much money do you get from Davidson College?
We don't get any money from Davidson College, so that's an easy answer. Not any cash. The college works us into the infrastructure of the organization, so we have in-kind support. We don't have to have a human resources department. We don't have to have a financial services office, because that all works through Davidson College. But we raise 100% of our budget ourselves through the contributions of donors and through grants like the one that we've just lost. That's the answer about the college support. We're still very much a part of the college. We have to follow college rules. And so I don't think we would consider playing commercials. But I do have a strong feeling about the corporate support we receive, which makes it sound like it's only corporations, but it's also not-for-profit organizations, and in particular, arts organizations, with which we've had a long and fruitful relationship at WDAV because of our classical music format. So whether it's the Charlotte Symphony or Opera Carolina or Bach Academy, they need an outlet to amplify what they do, especially in a media environment where there aren't a lot of newspapers and there isn't a lot of interest in terms of commercial media for getting the word out about those arts organizations. And that's a role that WFAE and WDAV and Blue Ridge Public Radio play really in an outstanding way.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because we have focused this conversation a lot on news, because that's what WFAE does, but we also do cultural programming. Mm-hmm. So do you. You do a substantial amount of cultural programming. It could be argued. We talk about the arts here and athletics and other things. It's not just news. And in the absence of that kind of programming, which really pretty much only comes from public radio and public television, at least on the airwaves, mm-hmm. I think we would be poorer for it. Ellie, talk about this from your point of view, because Asheville's kind of an artsy area.
Asheville is an artsy area. I agree we'd be poorer for it. We talk a lot about making sure that we're covering the things that aren't being covered any other way. And I think that includes everything Frank just said for his market in Asheville. And I think it's incredibly important. You know, tourism is a huge part of what Asheville does. And so it is incredibly important that we have all those institutions here to support that. And Blue Ridge Public Radio both does receive underwriting from some of those arts organizations, but we also cover them all as well.
And of course, arts and culture programming goes back to the very beginnings of public radio and National Public Radio, et cetera, because that was one of the parts of the mission statement that Bill Siemering wrote many years ago. Much of the cost associated with running public-based radio station is experienced in paying NPR and other content creators for the programming that we air. Has anybody, Judan, discussed with NPR and other providers the possibility of either in the interim reducing what we pay because of this cutback in funding, or having a year free to pay nothing? Because most of the funds that come from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting come directly to stations who then pay for the programming. It doesn't come to NPR.
Well, that's correct. And I want to be clear, because this has been part of the political argument that those funds are like a pass-through to NPR. Obviously, for a station like WFAE, where that funding might represent, you know, about 10% all in. There's 90% of revenue that we generate that we can use to pay NPR. So those dollars aren't necessarily essential for us to pay NPR. We have talked to NPR, and NPR has also been thinking about various ways to offset the impact of some of this. They currently right now are looking at how to look at the dollars that stations are losing and create a new formula for what stations will pay in the upcoming fiscal year. There are talks about how, as a system, we relook at the model and chart a new way forward together.
The Trump administration has been making lots of cuts in agencies and departments and in grants that have taken place in everything from science and technology to medicine and now public broadcasting. They are essentially reshaping the government and putting their stamp on how the government should operate. And you can agree or you can disagree with that approach. But most of these cuts have come through executive orders from the White House. This came through an act of Congress. What does that tell you?
It's a very interesting dynamic that's happening right now with the executive orders. And what I will say, having watched a lot of the hearings where these things were being debated, there is a rift in Congress among those who feel that Congress has a unique and distinct role in the execution of governance in this country, and that despite who's in the White House, that should not be usurped. And that was some of the debate that happened around the Rescission Act. But what we see is that there is also a strong party allegiance that's happening where folks are in line with the current administration based on their party, and that some of the bipartisan nature that happens in appropriations, there seems to be some erosion there as a result of that.
I want to ask both you and Ellie, and I'll start with Ellie on this because she's been out of this conversation for a while now, about this left-leaning bias that we are accused of by some on the right. I talked a little bit about this with Bill Siemering. There is this impression that we are left-leaning, and some people, at least as we navel gaze, it's because we'll talk about anything. We'll talk about everything. And that's the beauty of public radio. But some people find that offensive, and they think that because we talk about it, we endorse it. And that is not necessarily the case. So, Ellie, do you think that's a fair criticism, number one? And how do you prevent it from preventing bias from leaking onto the airwaves?
I don't know if I agree it's a fair criticism. I definitely think it's a fair question to ask. I think we should always be asking if we're doing what we are trying to do, what we said we'd do, what we're asking our listeners to pay for us to do. I certainly don't think Blue Ridge Public Radio's left-leaning, and I've listened to FAE enough to think that you aren't as well. But I would say I've always had this theory that part of why public radio's called left-leaning is because we allow people to talk till they're finished. We have these long stories, 5-minute stories, 7-minute stories, 9-minute stories, where you can put all the facts in the story. And when you have one column inch or 30 seconds on TV, you don't get all of those things, and people get really used to it. And then when they get 9 minutes, they don't know what to do with the last 7 minutes of facts.
And Judon, you come from the newspaper business directly from before you came here. How do you prevent, either in newspapers or in the news pages, not the editorial pages, either there or here for that matter, how do you keep bias, because everybody's biased, how do you keep it from leaking onto the air?
Well, we, in terms of our staff, you know, we take a very, you know, we abide by ethics. And so we understand that our role is to facilitate conversation, not to drive it. There are always moments where people make mistakes, I was just listening to an interview on the internet. I can't remember which outlet. It was in public media. Mm-hmm. And the reporter was saying, well, don't you feel this? And aren't you concerned that, right? And the questions were very leaning. You don't hear that at WFAE. I don't tend to hear that a lot in public media. There have been times where I've heard something and I've thought, well, let's let them tell us what they think instead of leading them to what they think. So we take that very seriously. We look back at our reporting. You know, I and our executive editor, we have conversations about, hey, well, you know, let's look at our choice of words. Let's make sure that we're really walking that line so that the audience can make their decision. And that's been true for every newsroom that I've worked in. And I've been in the media business for over 30 years in newsrooms across this country. You know, we don't wake up every day with an agenda to represent one point of view and one point of view only.
Frank, I know you wanted to jump in on this.
I just wanted to add that we occasionally will hear from a listener who accuses us of being woke because of the efforts that we've made to embrace composers of color and women composers and diversify the playlist. So we're not immune to that political argument either. But for us, it's never been about politics. It's been about bringing classical music to as many people as possible so that they can benefit from the inspiration it provides. And we've been doing it since before I ever heard DEI. We had our bilingual program Concierto just because I was able to do it, and I did. And we wanted to make sure that people who were coming to this area speaking Spanish would know that they were welcome here. So I think it's something that no public media is immune to. And it's, from my perspective, not just.
Ellie, you wrote an article in April for your website at Blue Ridge Public Radio in which you said that the move to cut funding, this is prior to the funding cut, but you said that the move to cut funding to CPB, quote, sets in motion a significant shift that could impact every local station in the country. And more importantly, you said, this signals a broader effort to not only take away critical funding, but to destabilize the very foundation of public broadcasting. Is that how you see this, as a means of further destabilizing the dissemination of news and information, another attack on the media by Donald Trump and his allies?
I do see it that way. And I think it's really interesting because, you know, we were talking about 14 counties in the Koala boundary. There are a lot of places that are very small and a lot of places that are conservative in those areas that we're taking news entirely away from.
And this comes at a time, Jadon, when local news outlets have been collapsing. This station and other platforms have been working together, something that never happened earlier in my career. We would never even acknowledge the presence of another outlet. But now we are physically working together to report the news because it's the only way we can make it happen economically. Mm-hmm. So if you believe in democracy, which can only function with information, accurate information, would you intentionally take this step to cut these funds?
You wouldn't. When you look at the research that's happened around the decline of local news, more than 3,000 news sources have disappeared across this country since 2005. What we've seen in terms of that research is when that happens, civic participation goes down, people become more partisan, more divided. And so if you really care about the health of our communities, the health of our democracy, you would invest more into media, not less.
Donald Trump has sued ABC and CBS. They have capitulated. He sued universities. He sued law firms. Many of them have capitulated on this. And the CBS suit was thought by many legal experts to be absolutely frivolous. But a merger was at stake, and broadcast licenses have been threatened. Now that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is no longer funding us, is the next step to threaten the license of public stations that maybe don't toe the line?
Well, the FCC has already launched an investigation into whether we are actually airing commercials versus the underwriting guidelines that we abide by. And so you can take that for what it is, but it seems to be an outright attack on public media and media in general.
I was going to ask you about this anyway, but we have an actual listener who sent in an email about this because we have a perfect storm of monetary events that have taken place here in the last several years, not the least of which is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but the other is the fact that we have this building downtown that we entered into an agreement with to use as a center for gathering, which was pre-pandemic idea. It's costing us a decent amount of money. What are we doing about that building?
So we're looking at all options. What I will say about this is that WFAE has always been very ambitious in terms of how do we expand our service and support to the community? How do we bring people in so that they can touch and be part of the journalism that we create? The vision for that building was to do exactly that, to move our broadcast operations out of this basement that we currently are in University City and into the heart of Charlotte, where our reporters could have access to politicians, to artists, to community members who can come in and gather. In light of this perfect storm, as you describe it, we are looking at everything and readjusting our expenses accordingly.
And a Facebook comment from one of our listeners: like many of the federally funded programs being canceled, could any of the federal public broadcasting funds shift to state or local tax funds instead, outside of funding local NPR stations through fund drives? What else can the supporters do to keep NPR on the air? We have 30 seconds, and there's no way the state's giving us any money. So
no, we've seen states across the country already cutting funding to public media at the same time that the federal cuts are happening.
And with that, we will end this conversation and just pray that our listeners understand what's going on here and how they can help, and that they will, in fact, help. Judon Marshall from WFAE, Ellie Ellis from Blue Ridge Public Radio, Frank Dominguez from WDAV. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.